It's an interesting thought. Sometimes people ask these kinds of questions, and maybe you have, but one of them is like, when they find out, you know, a new convert finds out the Bible wasn't actually written in Latin, and then they, no, it's not, did they find out it wasn't written in Latin, and all of a sudden they find out it's written in a different language, and why, if they were controlled by the Romans at that time, was it written in Greek? Why Greek out of all the languages? Why was the gospel given the ability, considering this was a hostile region where, you know, nation after nation was constantly at war, and they were concerned about some of their political intrigues and less concerned about keeping order, you know, at a period just before this. And why was it that all of a sudden, when the gospel appears, that there are new roads, there's new order, there's new laws, there's new peace that all helps, if you're a man like Paul, traveling by foot from nation to nation? Why was that to be the case? You know, why was it when we look at some of these things that the gospel could make it through these lands? Why was it that Pilate and Herod were both involved in the trial of Christ? Why not just Herod? And why not just Pilate? Why did these things all happen the way they did? How was a world like that, filled with unbelievers, how was that possibly made ripe for the gospel to come from place to place and to be accepted with such ease? We're going to return to our study. We've just had a wonderful study, and I will give you one more week of that, probably coming up in 2 weeks. But we've had a profitable study about the period in the Old Testament, after we finished the Old Testament survey, and what was going on historically, and that's been very interesting. I know many of you said very interesting study, very profitable study. We want to come back to this, our survey now of the New Testament, and our goal is not different from what it was before. Our goal is to give you an overview of the books in the New Testament, not to go in depth like you do. Like you come on a Wednesday night, we're walking through a book chapter by chapter. You know, that's not what we're going to do here. What we do want to do is give you a survey. We want to give you an overview on what's happening in all of the books of the New Testament. We want to give you some of the background on what's going on in all of those so that you'll be able to deal with the books when you're reading them for yourselves, to try and help see how some of these things fit together. We want to give you some of the potentially cultural, historical issues that are taking place that will help when you're trying to study the book and to interpret it for yourself. Now, if you're looking at what I've got up here, you're probably realizing that if you've got a good Protestant Bible, it goes from Malachi, and what's the next book? Matthew. We generally think of this in terms of Old Testament and New Testament. So what's the intertestamental period? It's about 400 years between those two particular times. So the Lord's dealing with his people. There's the prophetic word that's going out. And now we come to this silence from God. There is no prophet he sends that we know of to his people during this time. And really many radical changes. It's almost as though the Lord wants to set up the coming of Christ. And it is. You know, if some of you, I'm looking around, are currently or have been choir members, you would know that some of the most important, quote, notes, I suppose we could say, on the page are what? They're rests. You know, it's the rest that's done well that emphasizes what comes next. You know, you don't just sing straight along without those. The Psalter includes these little words off to the side, and some people mistakenly read them when they read the Psalms, read them out loud, and that's that little word Selah, which basically is a rest, because it's a poem. And so it's built in. And normally you don't sing and then go, you know, the choir doesn't then say, rest, you know, there's this pause. Yeah, well, if you do, then we got to talk to you guys. So that's not how it goes. It's the same thing with the Psalter. There's this rest, and It sets you up for what's coming next, and it just makes it, you know, far more dramatic. Well, the same thing can be true when we're looking at what God is doing here. I'm reminded of the verse, the verse, in the fullness of time, from Galatians 4:4. In fact, somebody, they're not here right now, but they kept saying, I wish we would hear something about that as we're going through Advent. Well, Mr. Wan covered that for an evening service without me telling him that. And this is where I want to talk about some of the things that went towards making this the fullness of time. In this period of 400 silent years between the Old Testament and New Testament, the New Testament describes the ending of that period as the pleroma, as the fullness, as the completeness, or as especially the timeliness. This is the fullness of time concept, that this is just the right moment. This is God's plan for all of human history, and all of that, not just without any planning, but very, very much to the point, is this is the moment when the Savior should come, and I have set things up for it to take place in that time. And so that's what we're going to take a look at, is what are the things that make this, that are going on during this sort of emphatic pause of 400 years that are preparing for the Savior to come? Because these are not unimportant years. So let's talk about these final days, in the final days of the Old Testament. In 445 B.C., the wall in Jerusalem had been finished. Daniel was done with his prophesying. Nehemiah's leadership had come to a conclusion. And Israel, as it was left at that point in time when the Old Testament closes, is essentially a vassal state of Babylon. So they don't really run things. They're really having to get supplies and report to and do what the people back in Babylon tell them to do. And it goes on, and then Cyrus comes in later, and there's more freedom that's given. But it's continuing in a region, just as we've been looking at for Egypt. You'll notice again and again, the point was that the pathway, whether you were going up to Syria, out to Africa and Egypt, or even trying to go across to Babylon and down, if you were in that section, the pathway that was established because of the geography and topography, there was one way to travel. You start out in the desert, you better have a lot of camels with a lot of water, because you're not going to get it in that desert. And those wildernesses were deadly. I know of a man, a friend of mine, who decided to take the hike from Jericho to Jerusalem. I've covered that distance in an air-conditioned bus. He almost died on that roadway. Somebody had to finally come and bail him out, because you got to get more dehydrated, you become more disoriented, and you know, and it's just deadly in that heat. And so here we have this period where everybody is a different nation group around. They're all in conflict. They're at war with each other. And in order to get to where they want to go, they have to go through Palestine. They have to go through Israel. And, you know, as long as you're going through it, you might as well conquer it and put your little safe, you know, stations all through that land. So for 400 years almost, the Israelites were not independent, and they were a geopolitical football in that area from one group to the next to the next. So let's just take a look at a little of that when we see the frontiers. And how did all of these disparate groups that are all around this area, how did this boil down to a place where people shared the same culture, for example? And in 331 B.C., not in Israel, but across the sea, in what would be considered northern Greece, the land of Macedonia, a land that we would today call the Balkans, but was a Greek state. The Greek state of Macedonia was ruled by King Philip. And Philip passes away. His son is a name you probably know quite well, Alexander the Great. And in 331 BC, Persia was conquered by Alexander. One of the far-reaching parts of, all the way up to the Indus River, they conquered. Just the largest kingdom. Guys, if you want to feel somewhat discouraged with how much you've accomplished in life, you know, Calvin was in his early 20s when he finished the Institutes. Alexander the Great was 23 when he controlled the largest empire the world had ever known at that time. And every empire in front of him fell under his sword, and he took them over. And this was an interesting thing because his influence was spread throughout the region. And that's very interesting for our studies of the New Testament. So one of the things that Alexander's father did for him was to secure a tutor. And the tutor that he secured was a man of no little reputation, Aristotle. You know, if Andy was here getting ready for his final ordination exam, we'd give him a little crib sheet, you know, because he has to take a philosophy exam. And, you know, in the little crib sheet, we would talk about the three most prominent, you know, Greek philosophers. And the first was Socrates, who didn't really write the stuff down. His much of what we know about him comes from Plato, who was his student and was the next great philosopher and established the academy in Athens. And then his student, his brightest student, was Aristotle, who set up the Lyceum and was extremely famous, extremely influential, and extremely popular teacher. So when King Philip of Macedon secured him to move to Macedon just to be the tutor of his son, it was a significant part of his view of the world that he was able to form in Alexander the Great. And the theme that was passed on to Alexander was a theme of unifying things, unifying science, unifying the fields of science, unifying culture. And that's how Alexander took it. So unlike other people who had conquered, you know, like the Assyrians would conquer Israel, and when they conquered Israel, they'd take the people out of the land, and they would split them up into different parts of their empire, and they would just lose their identity completely. Aristotle had a different view. He wanted to bring Greek culture to the world, but he also wanted to preserve what he thought were the best elements of the various countries that he conquered and include them in the culture he was spreading. And so there's a difference. Sometimes you'll read this if you're reading books about influences on the New Testament or reading about the New Testament, you'll see the term Hellenistic to describe the culture. And then in other places, you'll be reading about the Greeks and you'll see Hellenic. And you look at them and you kind of go like, okay, same thing, right? No. Hellenic culture was pure Greek culture. Hellenistic culture was this unifying culture that Aristotle was building. And so, you know, he wouldn't wipe out the temples in Egypt, but he would take some of the things he liked about their government, some of the things he liked about their culture. He would work them into this Hellenistic society, and then he would move on. And then he's conquering Persia, and there were some things that he liked about Persia. We wish he hadn't, but there's some things about Persia that he liked, and he inculcated, and he was moving down to conquer Babylon when he died. And so from Greece to Babylon to India to Egypt, this entire region, which, by the way, includes Palestine, is under the influence of Hellenistic culture. And not only Hellenistic culture, but the language of the Hellenists, which was Greek, Koine Greek, as opposed to classical Greek. And so Koine Greek became the language of politics. It became the language of culture. It became the language of business. You know, it's much like English today. You want to fly an airplane as a pilot? You have to know English. You want to be able to use a lot of scientific data? You'd better have somebody who knows English fairly well. You want to, you know, you get into another country. I get a kick out of, you know, I'm walking down the streets in Yangon. You know how taverns make a lot of money? They have an outdoor open area, and the entertainment for the night is somebody teaching English as a second language. So, you know, I'm walking by the street and you see these people. And so, you know, I'm kind of peeking in to see what this is like. So, like, they get the free English lesson as long as you're sitting there and buying beer or something of that nature. And so those two go together. So I suppose if you meet somebody from another country and they speak English with a slur, you know where they studied. My favorite thing about it, though, is that they're teaching English, and I'm listening to this and going, this guy who's teaching has never spoken English. You know, he's teaching them stuff that is so wrong, but let's just keep moving. I don't want to tell 500 people they've just been cheated. So anyways, Alexander spread the language, and in the same way, it's like English. I go somewhere today, you know, I'll still remember in Rwanda being taken at machine gun point into a barbed wire sandbagged encampment where one of the people who was involved in genocide was now the governor of the province. And I'm, you know, Len's a great linguist, but he didn't know French at all. And I'm sitting here all this trip brushing up on enough French so I can order food. And so I'm supposed to talk to this guy. So I have this whole paragraph ready to go. And I walk in. He says, President is going to switch language to English. Let's speak English. I said, okay, that's good. It's like that. You go almost anywhere in the world, and you're going to find people who will speak English in that land. And that was that's what happened throughout the world because of the influence of Alexander the Great. Not only that, he took a large scientific expedition with him. He took a number of what they considered as scientists and philosophers with him, such a large caravan of students and sort of like hunter-gatherers. They collected flora and fauna and cultural artifacts from every part of the lands that he conquered, and they were all being sent back to Aristotle to study and to bring forward. They estimate, if you account for inflation, that the modern world has not surpassed the amount of money that Alexander the Great spent on scientific research until we got to the space program. So, you know, it tells you kind of the massive amount of energy that went into this, because adjusting the culture of the whole world, learning from it and adjusting it, was a part of what he intended. And that was the Hellenistic culture. You think about how beneficial that was for the Lord to appear on that scene. So, you know, the Jews, unbelievably, with all this going on, have translated the Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint. And we know from people who are much sharper than I am at linguistics and textual study that in most cases the Bible that Jesus is quoting from is not the Hebrew Old Testament. It's the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament, because that makes it available to the people that he's speaking to. Much of his preaching and much of what was said was being done in Greek. And certainly the New Testament was prepared in Greek. Even the book that's really marked, that gospel that's particularly addressed to the Roman mindset, is written in Greek, not Latin, which was their language at the time. But all of them understood the common language. Not only was there a common language, but, you know, when you're traveling into another country and another culture and you're trying to explain the gospel and you're trying to teach them the principles from the Word of God, there's a strain at times to think about, how does this people think? And therefore, what do I need to correct? What do I need to say that will relate? And it's really a major part of adapting to how you speak to people in another culture. For example, if you're going into Asia and a number of Buddhist countries, just the idea that there's a personal God and as opposed to a Star Wars kind of force is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And so if you're going to be evangelistic there, you can't just say God, because they have no thought of that being what you think. You know, every once in a while you'll get a translator and you'll say a concept like that and he'll be real good and he'll go, okay, just touch you on the arm and go, just a second. And then he talks for a long time. And you're thinking, I just said like one word. What is all of this? And, you know, and then he comes back and he says, that concept doesn't translate. I just needed to put it in, you know. So there's a lot that goes on. And think about what it would mean to be able to go through the known world, the largest empire in the world, and to be able to have a common cultural frame of reference for everyone in every town and village and city that you went to. That was what was going on during these 400 silent years. That's the reason the New Testament is written in Greek. That's the reason that Paul, even though he's writing to Jews as well as Romans, has no problem making references to, like, the Olympic Games, to athletic competitions, to crowns that are given in those games, because that context has been spread through every area that he went to. And it would resonate with all those people. You know, lay aside every weight and sin that will so easily beset you would generally not have made sense to a Jewish audience 400 years earlier, or probably to an Assyrian audience, or many. But because of what was done during this time period, that really resonated with them. Then we have these are the frontiers that are unified. I should have put that up already. All right, there we go. Fragmentation. You have this enormously unified culture under one ruler, one language, one cultural paradigm, and he dies suddenly. He conquered out to Persia in 331. He came back. He's about to finish his conquest of Babylon in 327, and he dies. At his death, his son was recognized by everybody, even him, as insane. And so he did not put him, which you wish at times, knowing what the Romans did in some cases, they would have followed suit. But no, they didn't. They put idiots and insane people on the throne. This man dies. He knows his son is insane. And so his empire is going to be divided up among the generals. And you know, if you take eight generals and want to divide one empire, that will be done by peaceful, rational negotiation, right? No, not at all. Eight becomes four. Four of them are eliminated. I'll leave that up to your imagination. And then the four who are left, two of those are particularly significant to the New Testament. The Seleucids or Seleucids, alternate pronunciations, are ruling over the Syrian part of the Hellenistic Empire. And the Ptolemies, spelled with a PT, the Ptolemies are ruling over Egypt. And initially, when this happens, the control of Israel and Palestine, that falls to the Ptolemies. And then, beginning about 320, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, which, by the way, were constantly at war, and the direct route between Syria and Egypt was Palestine. I mean, they have armies moving through their land constantly, armies struggling to control them, and finally, the Ptolemies lose to the Seleucids, and the Seleucids, or Seleucids, are the ones who now take over the control of Jerusalem and Israel. And one would think this might not be such a bad thing. Except Antiochus III is the ruler at that time. And Antiochus III, probably the only person that was ever said, had more of a desire to unify the world with Hellenistic culture. He was more avid for that than Alexander the Great. He was more aggressive about it. And he was more coercive about it. And so under his influence, the Jews in Palestine saw their freedoms being redacted. They had less and less control of what they could do, less and less control of anything that could go on. In fact, we begin to see the foreign influence seeking to promote not just conform in outward ways, not just come and enjoy a horse race, but convert, become Greeks. Yes? Pardon me? Hedonists, yes. But they were also worshiping Zeus and etc. So they were following the traditional Greek pathway, and as I said, Alexander loved some of the ways of the other cultures too much, and that was one of the ways. So, you know, Greeks tended not to be of that culture generally, but that was the pattern with the Seleucids. So, in response to this pressure to convert, the Jewish nation begins to break up into subgroups. And one of the first that arises among Judaism are the Hasidim. And you probably know that term because we still have, largely around Manhattan, Hasidic Jews. And if you've seen a Hasidic Jew, you probably notice they are the most radical in their dress and adherence to Jewish law. I mean, you can walk in and be sitting down talking to a Reform Jew and never know it while he's having a ham sandwich and talking to you. But, you know, among the Hasidic, they don't even want to talk to you generally. They don't want a lot of contact with you. We'll leave that other story go by the wayside. But anyways, another group that came up during this time we begin to see are the Pharisees. Now, the Pharisees, if there ever was, the Pharisees are the fundamentalists of the Old Testament. Their name means separatist. And their emphasis was to be separate from this Hellenizing influence that was going on and to be resisted. So the Hasidim were, you know, extremely conservative, but I think even just more so, maybe like the Amish, locked into a period of their history. The Pharisees were devoted to the law, devoted to the covenant of God, devoted to remaining apart from worldly influences. And in that way, they were very good. By the time we meet them in the New Testament, they're some of the greatest opponents that Jesus has. And that's not only because they didn't see how he fit the fulfillment of Jewish prophecies, but it's just an illustration of how starting off with a good idea and a good plan can sometimes go awry and take a hard turn. And you can still be committed to trying to do X, but in the meantime, you lose the whole purpose for it and the meaning for it. And so this was another group that arose during this time. If you come into the New Testament, the organized opposition against the ministry of Christ among the Jews, which was necessary for the fulfillment of many prophecies, wouldn't have been there. But it was because of the influence of Antiochus III. The Jewish culture continues this kind of fracture underneath of Antiochus III until eventually, in 175 B.C., Antiochus IV comes into power. And Antiochus IV, of the same dynasty, Antiochus IV gave himself the nickname, so to speak, Antiochus Epiphany. And by epiphany, generally translated, manifestation. Not enlightenment, which it could also mean, but manifestation. And the inference of that was that he was God incarnate, was what he's really claiming. And he lived his life seeking to be, as often they have in Greek myths, you know, sort of incarnate demigods. And so that was his perspective on himself. And in order to prove that, he took the Hellenization that Antiochus III had been forcing on the Jews, he took it to a whole new level. He outlawed, get this for Jews, he outlawed Sabbath keeping. You know how well that would go over, right? He outlawed owning a copy of the Hebrew Scriptures. This is, you know, sounds like the Counter-Reformation going on in Europe. He made owning a copy of the Scriptures being circumcised. Tell Jews you can't be circumcised. No Sabbath, no circumcision, two of the great marks of the Jewish faith, no Scripture, Pharisees are done. And by the way, the penalty for any one of those three was death. That's how aggressive he was. And eventually, he does what is sometimes referred to as the abomination. Eventually, in 167 B.C., he breaks into the Hebrew temple and he sacrifices a pig on the high altar to Zeus, which now desecrates the temple so much that the Jews can't worship there. That's the man that we see here. He was so harsh, so cruel, and just even Jews who weren't that concerned, so expensive to support, that an uprising took place. And a family of freedom fighters comes on the scene in about 164. And these are the Maccabeans. And if you are familiar with some other books, you might see the titles on there. The Maccabeans, starting with Matthias and his five sons, lead a guerrilla warfare against the Syrians, the Seleucids. And their capital is miles and miles away. And so it's a strain for them. They keep attacking. Early on in the revolt, Matthias dies, and his third son took over, whose name was Judas. And Judas was given the nickname the Hammerer for his influence. And that nickname, which is translated Maccabeus, passed on to the whole dynasty. So all of the people in his family who were leading successive revolts were known as the Maccabeans. And the Maccabean revolt continued. It was, just down to tooth and nail at some points. There is a story about them being trapped in the temple for days. And by the way, out of that comes the story of they ran out of oil for the menorah, which has seven branches. But miraculously, it continued to be lit until they were able to be delivered. And hence the revolt that essentially broke the power of the Syrians, the Seleucids, and has a story attached to it, is what is celebrated by Jews at Hanukkah in December every year. That's the basis of it. It was the result of this fight for freedom, at which point, finally, the Maccabeans were able to negotiate personal freedoms for the Jews. They could worship again. They could cleanse the temple and restore the temple for worship. They could own the scriptures. They could keep Sabbath. They could circumcise their children. And so, as Abraham's children, they had never faced such a horrible time. But this really continued to give them encouragement until, again, the Maccabeans in 142 B.C., under the leadership of this family, they were able to secure the total independence of the Jewish nation from any foreign power. And that lasted from 142 B.C. to 63 B.C. I think it's safe to say that between